Hello, and welcome to the Classicist Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, here with Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Ilya Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, want to turn today to a subject that you've been writing about recently, the tensions running through American politics and American culture. This is a political divide and a lifestyle divide, and in some senses is a function of geography and class. And people talk about it as political polarization, but I think it's fair to say that it runs deeper than that. Some people refer to it even as a cold civil war. But before we get to your diagnosis of some of the causes of this, let me just get you to respond to this at a conceptual level. Put this in a historical context for us, because skeptics will say, you know, America and American democracy, it's always been contentious. It's always been freewheeling. We never really had this golden age of American unity. So maybe we shouldn't freak out too much about this. It's always been a divided place, and there's nothing about this moment that's particularly outlandish, and certainly nothing to invite comparisons to the Civil War. How do you react to that proposition?
Well, there are two periods that are analogous. One was during the Great Depression in the 30s, where we had socialist candidates that got over a million votes. And the 1968, the 60s, and there were bombings. I think in 71, there was a bombing almost every single day in New York. But why I think this is a little different is that in two ways. One, it's geographical and cultural. So we're back to the 1850s of sectarianism. There's basically an area around the Great Lakes, Minnesota, or some liberal areas in upper Michigan or New York, and then there's the East Coast and the West Coast and everything in between, which is red. And people are self-selecting. They go to a red state or a blue. If they want culture and they don't mind taxes, they go to San Francisco. If they want to get out of California, they go to Boise, Idaho, or Provo, Utah. And it's getting that intensifies the cultural breakdown. The other thing is it's holistic. And that by that, I mean, I don't remember in the 60s that sports, NFL, NBA, a little bit in Grammys and Oscars, late night comedy, but it's holistic now. Every single thing is politicized, partly with the onset of the Obama administration and then its antithesis in Trump. We're going to have 12 years of everything, politics, 24/7, all the time. And we've got two different competing visions. We've got one that believes in a quality result, and the state has a mandatory obligation to make sure that we're equal on the back end, and the other, a vision of quality of opportunity and liberty on the front end, and that if people do well, they have a moral or an ethical or religious responsibility to help others rather than have the government confiscate 60-70% of their income and then you have a bureaucracy redistribute. And that's the dividing point, and it's starting to be geographical.
Now, you wrote about this recently for National Review, and you identified in that piece a number of the factors that you think have contributed to this. So here's how I want to proceed with this. I will give you sort of the optimist take on each one of these issues, and then I'll let you explain where you think those rationales fall short. And so the first factor you cite in the piece is globalization. And Victor, I think the optimist would say there, look at the sheer expansion of wealth, the number of jobs that have been created, the increase in consumer purchasing power that globalization has wrought, not to mention the fact they might also argue that this is something we really can't opt out of. This is the way that the global economy is moving, and you either sort of get on board or pay the economic price. So A, it's been good, and B, there isn't really an alternative. What's your reaction to that line of argument?
Well, there's a lot of merit to it, because if you're in the Amazon basin and you get glasses or penicillin, that's wonderful. So it's really a westernization of culture in a global sense, that a billion people in the West have sent their culture to 7 billion. The problem with it is anybody who has muscular labor that can be replicated elsewhere will be replicated elsewhere. I mean, manufacturing, farming, construction, some of it, industrial processes with cheaper labor and less regulations. So what that means is that somebody's going to be a loser, and then anybody that's in the information business like me or you or Stanford University or Facebook or Apple or genetic engineering that requires some education and expertise that can't be replicated to the same degree, or high finance. You know, China can't make Stanford yet, and nobody's going to write my syndicated column yet from South Korea. Then we are dubbed winners, which is okay, but our compensation in cities in blue state America has gone astronomically up, and people in red state has gone astronomically down. And they say to us, well, before you can get on social media or before you can talk to that iPhone, somebody's got to produce food for you. And you all like those granite counters, and you like those stainless steel refrigerators, and you like those wood floors, and you like those cars. Somebody produces those. And you're just basically telling us that we're going to get it all from overseas and we're not valuable anymore. And we bought into that, as they were, that they were losers, that they didn't get with the agenda. And Trump came along and said, we can make it better. We can make it as reliably. We can make it as cheaply. And it's valuable. And so that was what the... That was what the argument is over. And it's a geographical argument once again. Globalization's winners are on the coast, and its losers are on the interior.
The next factor that you cite in the piece is tech. And here one doesn't have to strain too much to make the optimist case, because we hear it all the time. This notion that the average American is walking around with a level of computing power in their pockets that would have been unfathomable just a generation ago, and that the stores of knowledge that are now available to anyone on demand, the connectivity that has really marginalized the effects of distance, that these are all sort of undiluted goods. So what do you see as tech's role in driving this cultural division?
Well, tech is essentially a monopoly, because if you're not on, if you want to do a Google search, or you want to use, you know, when you want to write something on a computer, you're going to use Microsoft. And if you're going to tweet, you're going to use Twitter. And if you're going to, you know, there is such a word as Google, to Google something. And so what's happened is that, unlike electricity or gasoline or interstate commerce, these aren't regulated and they're very progressive. And so your information that you give, inadvertently, their way to collect data, their way that they censor you, the way that they direct your speech, all of that can serve a particular agenda. And the agenda that it serves is sort of an internationalist, transnational ideal, and it's very left-wing. And what happens is that somebody in our, say somebody out here in Fresno, where I'm speaking today, Fresno County, Elizabeth Heng, is running for Congress as a Republican candidate, and she puts an ad on Facebook, and they said, you know what, it's obscene because you have pictures of your parents in Cambodia and there's a Cambodian Holocaust. And she says, well, how about Farrakhan or how about ISIS on there? And they say, no. And so for 10 crucial days during her campaign, she's banned from what is basically a public utility. And so that, we've never had public utilities called not public utilities, and so doctrinaire in one political aspect. They're very progressive and left-wing, and that divides people in their daily use of them. It's almost as if the people who are controlling your electricity or your natural gas into your house have a political agenda, and you find that one day you're lights don't go on because you've said something or that you've communicated something that they find is hate speech or something.
The next factor that you cite is the influence of the American college campus. And here, Victor, I think people will say, look, we've made higher education almost kind of middle-class entitlement, and we're imparting more knowledge to more people than has ever been done before. And yes, there might be some fringe types here and there on college campuses, but by and large, they're still a force for good in American life. Tell us why your diagnosis might be different.
Well, what happened is we had the federal government come in and subsidize student loans, and then that gave the green light to the universities to up their tuitions over the rate of inflation. So we have an aggregate $1 trillion of student debt, and there was no cost accountability. So we have gender studies or ethnic studies professors making 15% more than humanities professors, and even math and engineering professors on average. Or you have the CSU system, you have a 200% growth in administration, largely because of diversity. So you have all this added on cost, and it's all piled on the shoulders of the students. And yet it's occurring when the curriculum is getting therapeutic. So we have more and more of these dash studies courses. And we've talked about this before: peace studies, women's studies, ethnic studies, black studies, environmental studies, etc. And so the student then graduates not in 4 years, but 6 or 8 years. And half of them in the largest university system in the world here in California, the CSU system, don't graduate. So 51% graduate, but not in 4 and 6 years. And then they have this huge debt, and then they're ill-equipped. They can't weld. They don't know how to drive a truck. They don't know how to lay tile. They don't know how to work a lathe. So they have a sociological background, or they have a psychology degree, and then they go out into this previously ossified economy, and they can't get a job, or at least not one that they feel is befitting their education. And so that creates a lot of animosity. And then you have the working classes who will say, you know what, that's your problem. You guys owe $1 trillion in debt. It could be $2 trillion because our tax dollars subsidize your education and the federal loans. And I didn't get an education. I drive a truck, and I'm very happy doing it. So there's a class dimension to all of this stuff. And then when you add in that the university itself, 90% of the professors in most polls are left-wing, and they feel it's their duty to prepare a graduate for what they consider a racist, sexist, xenophobic, nativist, protectionist, whatever world, and they only have them for 4 to 6 years, so they don't believe that they're being biased. They believe they're counterbalancing a right-wing, unfair life that awaits everybody, and they only have them for this brief period they don't call them doctors, prep them. And that's, you add all that together, and it's no wonder that there's a working class resentment against the university, because it didn't do what it was supposed to do. It was supposed to educate people, and it was supposed to do so in a financial mode that most people could afford, and it's failed on both counts. If we were to have an exit exam, I mean, universities always say they need entrance exams, SAT, ACT, but just have a national exit exam, basic knowledge, I think that we would learn very quickly. People either didn't do better after 4 years or actually will do worse on an exam than they did when they entered.
The next factor that you cite is driving the division, illegal immigration. Now, as we know, there is a contingent out there that regards the very existence and enforcement of immigration laws as anathema. I won't try to caricature that case, but let me attempt to present the slightly more temperate version of it, which is that, yes, we'd prefer legal immigration to its illegal counterpart, but America has a long history of assimilating immigrants. This is a creedal nation that doesn't regard race or national origin as barriers to entry in terms of becoming fully American. And the levels of illegal immigration are obviously suboptimal, but America is strong enough that this doesn't pose any threat to our social fabric. Why do you think it might be more dire than that?
Well, remember, the Democratic Party used to be against illegal immigration. I could find in 5 seconds on the internet, I can find great quotes from not just Barack Obama, but especially Bill and Hillary Clinton. And that was because they felt that they taxed the social service system, they being illegal immigrants, and poor people would lose access or they would be crowded out. Two, they competed with entry-level wages, and that wasn't fair. And three, they served the interest of corporate agriculture and were an obstacle to unionization. They were all legitimate. And then we had 1 million people come a year. We have 11 to 20 million at a time when we don't any longer have allegiance to the melting pot. We believe in the salad bowl or multiculturalism. And so what we did was we turned immigration from a limited, measured, legal, somewhat meritocratic, and diverse enterprise into mostly 50, 60% from Central America and Mexico, mostly people who do not have a diploma, mostly people who come illegally, and mostly people who don't have skills. other than entry-level jobs. And then we put them into a highly politicized, highly competitive economy. And so when somebody breaks their arm or they get old or they have five kids, then suddenly that job at the meatpacking plant or washing dishes doesn't look so much better than what was true in Oaxaca or Chiapas or Guatemala. But we have all these people who wants a piece of the illegal immigrant. We have the employer who wants more because this guy is now 40 or 50 and he's hurt or he's not as hardworking for such wages as he was. And then we have Mexico who gets $26 billion a year in remittances and uses these immigrants as pawns for their foreign policy, levers to affect U.S. policy toward the border. And then we have the Democratic Party who feels that either people become citizens through like the 1986 amnesties or their second generation children, but they feel they're changing the demographic and they flip California, they flip Nevada, they flip Colorado, they flip New Mexico, and they can flip Arizona and Texas and win in the Electoral College. And then, of course, you have the identity politics people, second and third generation, who feel that if you're Kevin Leon and you're sort of an obscure assemblyman, all of a sudden you're Kevin De Leon with an accent over your last O and you're Leon, and you've ethnicized your name, and suddenly you're an ethnic tribune. And so, and I'm just picking on one person, but it happens everywhere. So there's so many vested interest in having illegal immigration, but it really divides the people because a lot of entry-level jobs in the African-American or the barrio communities, those jobs, the wages have been depressed because of alternate sources of imported labor. People don't like the idea that certain people don't have to follow the law. They can pick and choose. They enter illegally. They reside illegally. The IRS said there was 1 million fraudulent IDs. If you or I or anybody who's helping to produce this podcast had multiple identities, then we would be committing a felony. Our careers would be ruined. Yet we have 1 million people here who do such things and are not considered at all serious crimes. And so that it divides everybody between those who feel that illegal immigration is going to change the demography politically, culturally, and this is going to be a good thing and the law shouldn't apply, and people who are more traditional and want measured, legal, meritocratic, and diverse immigration.
So the last question that I'll put to you, if we're in a tailspin, to what degree can we pull out? Are there factors that you look at and think, okay, this could actually maybe bridge the divide a little bit and pull at least some of the poison out of the debate?
Yeah, I think so. I think if we build a wall and we had E-Verify and we deported people here who had committed a crime and had never had a work history and just came without long residence, probably 1 million to 2 million people, we'd end up with 9 or 8 million people who were working. They had not committed crimes. They've been here for 5 years, let's say, and we could give them a green card. What they do after that's their business, but pay a fine, stay here, and then build a wall, and that would be the end of new immigration, and then we could go back to the melting pot, end all of this ethnic tribalism. And so if your name is Gonzalez or your name is Wilson or Chang, big deal. It doesn't give you any deficit or plus when you apply for a job or admissions. It's simply the way it used to be. And then on the education, as I said, I think we really need a national exit exam, and then we would see to what degree a particular college prepares its students, and we would learn very quickly that somebody who gets a degree at Hillsdale College in history is probably a lot better prepared than UC Irvine or UC Riverside or even Berkeley or Stanford for that matter, because they have a traditional curriculum. That would help. And I really think that these social media, I'm not a big fan of regulation, but if they're going to politicize these public utilities, then I think that they need to have some oversight, especially on things like product liability and monopolies and trust. I don't know why Google can, you know, buy out all the competition, or Facebook can buy up all the competition, and then we only have one outlet for social media use. That would help a lot, I think.
All right. Thanks to our listeners for tuning in. Remember, you can read Victor's work at Defining Ideas at hoover.org, as well as at victorhansen.com. And if you enjoy The Classicist, please rate the show on iTunes. For Victor Davis Hansen, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.